Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, of the making of books, there is no end. How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Well, hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, with me in the studio today, as always, is my famous producer, Mr. Dan Arnfield.
Hello.
Good afternoon, Dan. Nice to have you here. Well, I don't have any comments today, and actually, I could make a comment for this person, but the individual that wrote me and said you need to do Candace Millard's book. I talked about that a few weeks ago, and she wrote me a comment saying thank you for not revealing my name. She says, but it is a really good book, and we're really glad you're reading it. She says, in fact, I'm rereading it all over again. So I'll just keep your name quiet, but thank you for sending me that comment, and now send me a comment where you don't mind me reading it. So anyway, that's really great to have that. Now, for today's program, what I want to do is I want to continue discussing Candace Millard's book titled Hero of the Empire. And remember now, Candace is a best-selling author, and her books frequently appear on the New York Times bestseller list. And I find her to be a great historian and a great writer at the same time. Now, today what I want to do is we already covered the prologue, which is very exciting. As I said, it's like a spy movie for me. And we know that Winston, you know, he got out of prison, jumped over the fence, doesn't have any food, only have a few bars of chocolate, doesn't have a map, doesn't have a gun, doesn't have anything to escape. But what's interesting is Candace moves into chapter one, and essentially what she does, the title of that chapter is Death by Inches. And what's interesting about this chapter, I thought that was a really unique title, but essentially what Candace is doing is she opens this chapter with a discussion of Winston's fascination with war beginning in his early childhood. And essentially what this is actually a review for those of us who have read Winston Churchill's My Early Life. And so she's reviewing it with us. And so this is page 7. Again, now the title of it is Death by Inches. And so, but then she goes off, totally off the subject, and brings up another exciting subject, which I'm really trying to build a little bit of suspense. So anyway, I'll just mention a few little things that she says here. Remember the very opening of this. She talks about Winston when he was young and he had his 1,500 toy soldiers and he'd always line them up for his father and he pretended he was at war, at battle. So he would spend hours of playtime sending these 1,500 soldiers into battle. So she talks about that. And then she also, in a very early part of this book, this chapter, she talks about how Winston had desire to hear bullets all around him. You know, he couldn't wait to hear them. And then, of course, then he goes to Cuba and realizes that the bullet was like within a foot of his head, and it actually killed his horse and not him. So he kind of changed that. She also talks about Sandhurst. And again, we've read this and talked about this, but she talked about how Winston loved to participate in the war games at Sandhurst, but he was really disheartened that they were actually only games. He always wanted to be fighting and warring. Now, what is really interesting to me, and again, we're just, if you start looking at page 7, and I think it's really important, and for me and for all of your listeners out there. But she kind of jumps ahead, and she starts talking about the British Empire, and it's in some ways she's showing how unique Winston Churchill's life is, because he was raised an aristocrat, but he doesn't act like the aristocrats. And so, but I thought what we ought to do is spend some time with this and this section of this this half hour, and it's going to go really fast. Anyway, it's I'm calling it the Facts of the British Empire, and I'm going to offer a book for you as I get through this. Some of you will probably already have this book. But she talks about the British Empire and that he grew up in the British Empire. And he grew up with it. You know, his father was in politics. He grew up with the aristocracy. He grew up with wealth. I mean, he comes from, not only was his mother American, but he comes from a really popular family from Britain that they were, you know, in the government. And you know, so you can see, it's really interesting, and I think it is important to be positive about the British Empire. We have so much today about the evils of the British Empire and colonization and all that, but it's all lies. There's some things that were really great about the British Empire, and I'm glad she brought it out. So here's what she starts out by saying. That the British Empire, if we really think about it, it covered more than 1/5 of the world's land surface. That's a large, that's a large empire, and so these facts are amazing. Another fact she brings up is the British used their imperial power, but also took on vast responsibilities. And so that's where a lot of people say, oh, that colonialism, and they used their power and they took over these people and they ruined their lives and, you know, all of this. But what she says, and it really kind of struck me, she says they took on vast responsibilities. And so remember now, Winston Churchill, this is all related to him in a way as well, because he's growing up in the empire. He's growing up understanding it. He's growing up living a part of it. She goes on to say then, and again, this is all on page 7, the very first part of the, it's at the bottom of the page where she starts talking about this. She says, the British ruled 1/4 of the human race. 1/4. And it says, she goes on to say, it was more than 450 million people living on every continent and on the islands of every ocean. And so it was a huge empire. I love to read about the Roman Empire, and I want to read more about the Roman Empire, but the British Empire was much larger than the Roman Empire. And that's not something we think about. Everybody just goes to the negative. Oh, the colonization, they just did this, they did that. But the point is, when she talks about their vast responsibilities, one of the things that we really have to understand that the British actually brought health, education, trade, and industry to the nations they managed or ruled. And they also, you know, brought in housing. And they made the lands safe. They had military there to protect them. And so one of our employees here is, she's just right across the hall from me. She teaches kindergarten here. She grew up in India. And she has no negative thoughts about the British Empire. And she's actually a trained engineer. So she was educated, and so the British brought all that with them. They brought health, they brought education, they brought trade, industry, housing, and then they were safe when the British Empire was there. Now, those are very positive facts, which we don't hear enough all the time. And again, Candace Miller, she's not British, you know, but she sees how incredible it was. Now, she goes on to say, and this is at the top of page 8, it says, the British Empire was the largest empire ever known, outranking the once mighty Spanish Empire, which had been the original object of the awe-filled description of the empire on which the sun never sets. That was addressed to the Spanish Empire. Well, sorry, the British took it over, and the sun never set on the British Empire. She goes on to say that the British Empire was 5 times the size of the Roman Empire at its zenith. 5 times the size of the Roman Empire. And its influence over people, language, money, even time, for the clocks in every time zone were set to the Greenwich Mean Time, and that was unrivaled. So you know, they're even controlling clocks and time. But the thing is, it is, I remember as a boy growing up and hearing about Greenwich time, and I didn't understand that. I didn't, what does that mean? Greenwich, is there green witches? What is that, you know? But you have to know that Greenwich is a place, you know, and a lot of people followed the time from Greenwich. Now, she goes on to say, and again, all of this is there as background to, not only is it British history, but it's background to really get an understanding of Winston Churchill, to really focus on how we should understand him. She goes on to say on page 8, she says, by the time Churchill reached adulthood, the greatest threat to the empire no longer came from other major powers like Spain or Portugal or Germany or France, but from the ever-expanding burden of ruling its own colonies. And so that's what really was, you know, troubling or causing trouble for the British Empire. It was so big. And they were taking over many different peoples. And we've read about that. In my early life, we read about what happened in Pakistan and with the Pushtuns, and you know, how they, their favorite saying was, kill every Englishman you see. You know, so there weren't, not everybody in these colonies were necessarily happy with the British. And again, it's like if you look at America today, I mean, America has done some great things, but you have people today that absolutely detest America. And it's because, well, America has some principles. You know, American has morality. You know, America believes that people have, you know, God-given rights. And, you know, some people don't want other people to have God-given rights. They want to rule them and corral them and punish them. So when Winston comes on the scene, then you know what he wants to do, and it's not a bad thing, but what he wants to do is he wants to save the empire. That's why he wants to go out and fight. He wants to keep the empire going, and so really, you know, that is pretty interesting, and So again, I think it's very interesting that she brings this out very early in the book, and it really does set the, I think it does, you know, lay a really good, let's say, how would you say it, like a good concrete slab to build the rest of the book on. You know, this is the empire. This is the way he really grew up. It's part of his background. And she goes on now to say on page 8. She said that to Churchill, such far-flung conflicts offered an irresistible opportunity for personal glory and advancement. So all this facts that she's given us, she's saying now, Winston Churchill used it for his own ways. He used it for his own means. And he said, when he entered the British Army and finally became a soldier with the real possibility of dying in combat, Churchill's enthusiasm for war did not waver. On the contrary, he had written to his mother that he'd look forward to battle, not so much in spite of as because of the risks I run. And so in some ways, that's a definitely a good description of Winston Churchill, is he liked to run, take risks. You know, he did it as a young boy. You know, he and his brother were playing, and they were chasing each other, and he tried to get away from his brother, so he jumped into a pine tree and fell almost to his death, and he took a risk. He thought he could hold on. Well, it didn't happen. So she goes on to say, what he wanted most from his life as a soldier was not adventure or even battlefield experience, but a chance to prove himself. He wanted not simply to fight, but to be noticed while fighting. And we have to remember that the reason why he did this is he actually wanted to rule England. That's why he was, he used war and he used fighting, well, to put himself in the limelight so that they could see he's a real leader. And of course, look what he did for the world in World War I and World War II. He really did. He did lead people, and he helped overcome, the Nazis. But she goes on to say then, but for a member of Churchill's high social class, such bold, unabashed ambition was a novelty. It was not an outright scandal. He had been born a British aristocrat, a direct descendant of John Churchill, the first Duke of Marlborough, his parents' personal friends of the Prince of Wales, Queen Victoria's oldest son and heir. Yet in open pursuit of fame and popular favor, Churchill seemed far less Victorian than Rooseveltian. And so essentially, I think what Miss Millard is trying to say there, you have to remember his mother was American, and his father was British. And so he's more like Teddy Roosevelt than he was like a regular British aristocrat. And in some ways, you can see that after we've read and studied the book. You can see all of this happening. She goes on to say, the immortal Barnum himself had not a greater gift for making himself and his affairs the talk of the world. And of course, there was the famous movie came out, I think The Greatest Showman. That's all about P.T. Barnum. And so he was like a Churchill. He wanted to be noticed. So she even brings that out in this. She says, his first biographer, talking about Winston Churchill, Alexander McCallum Scott, would write just a few years later, Winston advertises himself as simply unconsciously as he breathes. She did. He can't help himself. He's always advertising himself. And some people accuse me of the same thing. So, especially my wife. She says, you're advertising yourself all the time. And, because I grew up, next to the bottom of the group. There were seven children in my family. I was sixth. So that's why my a lot of my passwords all include six, because I'm the sixth one. So I'm not even the baby. I'm not even, I guess I'm a middle born, what do they call that? Middle child. Yeah, they're the worst, So she goes on to say, in a world in which men were praised not just for their stiff upper lip, but for extreme modesty when it came to their own achievements, Churchill was widely criticized for being the most offensive of creatures and the medal hunter. No, we have this from my early life. Then she goes on to say, he was called a self-advertiser, a young whippersnapper, even by a reporter for the Daily Chronicle, Pushful the Younger. So we covered that before in my early life. But she goes on to say, and I think she really has a good perspective, He was not unaware of these criticisms. Even years later, bewildered by the viciousness which he was attacked, would admit that it was melancholy to be forced to record the less amiable aspects of human nature, which by a most curious and indeed unaccountable coincidence have always seemed to present themselves in the wake of my innocent footsteps. So he says, I'm innocent. You know, it just happens. I can't stop it. Said he was not, however, about to let them slow him down. And so we can see that in Winston Churchill. Hey, you can criticize me all you want. Call me push for the younger. Call me whatever you want. It's not stopping me. And so you know, all of us in some ways need that. We need to be, if we really want to do something, we really need to learn to go for it. And we don't have to be, obnoxious. We don't have to be maybe as obnoxious as Winston Churchill may have been. I would have liked to have met the man and talked to the man. We know he came to America, and in fact, he was really injured in New York City because he couldn't step into the street the right way. It was different than England, and he got hit by a car. But he came over, by the way, to make money. He was in the stock market and things like that. So he was a gambler. He liked to gamble. He liked to play his horses. He liked to do all those things. But here's where I think she's really honest about Winston. She says, Churchill knew that the surest and quickest route to recognition, success, and perhaps, if he was lucky, fame, was a military medal. It was the swift road to promotion, advancement in every arm, he wrote, the glittering gateway to distinction. Distinction, in turn, could be parlayed into political clout, opening a door into the kind of public life that he longed for, and which he believed was his destiny. So while the military was not, for Churchill, an end in itself, it was certainly a useful means to an end. And so we have to remember that. It's not that Churchill wanted to be a great soldier. He wanted to be a soldier so he could become a great politician. That's what he wanted. He wanted to be able to help the British Empire, as an aristocrat. She goes on to say, what he needed was a battle, a serious battle, one that would be talked about, would be remembered, and with a good dose of courage and a little showmanship on his part might propel him to the forefront of the military stage. For that, he was willing to risk anything, even his life. Now, all of that, what we just read on, we're on page 9 now, is she's preparing us to understand the Boer War and why and how important it was for him. And it was the Boer War that actually propelled him into politics. And we have to remember that she's just not writing. She's not just copying what he's already written. She's trying to lay the groundwork for us to really understand what's happening. And, in some ways, what she's going to give us now in the rest of this chapter is the history of the Boer War that prepared Winston, to be a leader. That's what she's giving us. The Boer War history is to show us this is what really propelled him into politics, and also even helping America and the world with World War I and World War II. She goes on to say now at the bottom, this is the bottom of page 9, and we could look at that as history. I'm going to run out of time here, which is okay. Churchill, she goes on to say at the bottom of the page, Churchill had seen real fighting for the first time in 1895. Instead of spending his leave playing polo or fox hunting like most young officers, he had gone to Cuba as a military observer, joining a fighting column of the Spanish army during an uprising that was a prelude to the Spanish-American War. So we have to also connect that history here. His mom is American. His dad is British. He's fighting as a military observer for the Spanish and in Cuba, but that actually ends up the Spanish-American War. And so here he's involved in all of that. He said it was here that he began smoking cigars, giving birth to a lifelong habit and a distinct preference for Cubanos. So he only wanted Cuban cigars, you know. And my dad was a cigar smoker too, and it was unbearable because we go. I remember when my dad he finally got a nice car. And it was a 48 Chrysler, and he could slip at least five or six of us in the car. And he'd always smoke cigars when we were driving. And it's like, ugh, you know. Anyway, I don't know how Winston smoked his cigars, but he certainly smoked them. He also liked champagne, too, by the way. So it said it was also here that on his 21st birthday, he heard the first time bullets strike flesh. In fact, he had nearly been killed by a bullet that, by the capriciousness of fate, had sailed just a foot past his head, striking and killing the horse standing next to him. In Cuba, however, he had been only an observer, not an active participant. And for Churchill, that would never be enough. So essentially, I just have a little bit of disagreement with Candace here, that he was nearly killed by a bullet by capriciousness of fate. And Winston Churchill really did believe that God had protected him many times when he was in wars. And so I think sometimes he may have mentioned it was capricious, but then when he got older and he really thought about it, he realized he felt like he was really under God's protection. All right. So we can move on to page 10, and maybe I'll just finish this sentence up here. It says, in Cuba, however, he had only been an observer. I'm sorry, I just read that. He said, Churchill's true education in the harsh realities of British colonial wars began the next year in the remote mountains of the British North India Northwest frontier, modern-day Pakistan. Now, we just covered that recently. So guess what? That's all the time I have for today's program. So on our next program, we'll continue to discuss Candace Millard's book. We'll stay with part one, titled Pushful the Younger. So it's actually part one and chapter one. And so you can buy Candace Millard's book at Amazon.com. You may be able to find a good used copy and less expensive copy at abebooks.com. But you may also be able to find a copy in your local bookstore. That very nice lady that sent me the comment and wanted me to keep her name quiet, she gets her book from the library. So she's not buying it. She's reading the library book. She told me she was going to go get it right away. So now you can check your local library. So there definitely would be a copy if you have a really good library. So please write me any good comments you may have to jbl@pcug.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at JBLiterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. And so until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.